Well, if you want to check to see if you're in the right session, this is the one on the Legend of Britain War Requiem. And we're going to listen to just a tiny snatch of it. And then today we'll talk mainly about the cathedral for which it was written and the text that is included, because both are very important. But here's a little bit. Confusion. It's a piece of music for which every note has intention. And I think this is really very important to know, that there's not an idle note in the whole piece. This all has significance and symbolism that's with it. So I wanted you to get just a taste of the music before we get to today's topic, which is to see what the cathedral is all about, how the this whole thing, the whole process got started. Sit down here for a minute. And on the back of the program that I handed you, by the way, I've done the piece 5 times, and this is from our last program. And what's important right now is the notes at the back end. I'll read you with you just the first couple of sentences of the program notes. On the terrible night of November 14th, 1940, fire came down from the skies over Coventry, England, in the form of incendiary bombs from German planes. The center of the city was destroyed, including much of the old cathedral. Out of the charred ruins, the next morning, a cross was erected from 2 burned beams, under which was inscribed, "Father, forgive." This was the spirit that grew from that dreadful night, a spirit of forgiveness and reconciliation, which was also important in the planning of the new cathedral. So, the new cathedral was not finished until 1962, and as part of the ceremonies, they commissioned various works of art and various pieces of music, and one of which was this war requiem from Benjamin Britten. And we'll talk about the music part of it tomorrow, but that's this is the reason that it was written as part of the dedication services. It's a work that can profoundly change how a person looks at war and how a person hears music. I think it's a lot of people feel it's one of the most significant works of the all of symphonic literature from the 20th century. It, because of the topic it deals with and because of the way Britten handles the music. So, the Coventry Cathedral officially is St. Michael's Cathedral. It replaces the old cathedral, which was in the 14th century. And they made decision early on that they would not redo the old cathedral. You know, just fill it in. Say, if you go to Dresden, and you have the Frauenkirche. The Germans did it differently there. They took the pile of rubble and sorted out every stone and made sure that they all got back into exactly where they were to begin with, or that they would make a new stone that would fit in that particular place. So what you have is a complete brick by brick, stone by stone replica of what was there before. And the people who decided in the rebuilding of the Coventry Cathedral felt they wanted to say something else, that would have a different kind of symbolism. But they didn't destroy the old one, they left it there. And you can see the new edifice from the old, or the old edifice, what's left of it, from the new. Have some of you been to Coventry to see this? Yeah. The thing is, if you go into Coventry, it's not one of the beautiful cities of England. It's not where you go to find the lovely thatched roof houses or the cathedrals like Salisbury that sit out in the countryside and have wonderful park around them. It's kind of squeezed right into the middle of the city. And that sort of is the feeling for the city in the first place, because it would be the equivalent in America of Detroit. So it was a place that, back into the Middle Ages, the guilds were there. They did a lot of manufacturing, a lot of work from the various guilds, and then it grew into a big industrial city. So part of the reason it was bombed is that's where war equipment and so on was being made, just as it would have been in Detroit in this country. So it is not a lovely grounds. It's what you need. If you go there to see it, you see it for this kind of symbolism that's going on. And if I can operate this now, we'll take a look at the cathedral itself. Coventry Cathedral. So what you're doing here is you're out in on the edge, the other side of the edge of the ruins, right? And this side, you're looking through the wall of the ruins, and through this empty spot right here, is where you get into the new cathedral, underneath that porch that's over the top. So you have here a juxtaposition of the old and whatever it stood for, and the new. And when we find the Britten War Requiem and the text for it, we're going to find the same thing, that he juxtaposes old and new. He picks up on that. Here is a diagram of the nave. So we were standing over here, about at number 6, looking in to it. And here's the new cathedral starts here. Here's the porch. Here would be the back wall. And the usual nave chancel. There are no transepts on the side. And the Lady Chapel is behind, of course, behind the high altar. The interesting thing, too, is that you can walk right through between the old and the new. So it's kind of like a pedestrian street that goes through there. This is one of the American contributions to the cathedral. Another very important thing that happened is that as part of the reconciliation idea, people from all over the world, from China, Japan, Germany, United States, Canada, all over, sent either gifts of money or artworks, or were in charge of a certain part of the building of the cathedral. So this is American. This was from artists from Oklahoma. called, it was called Christ Crucified. Her name was Helen Jennings, and it was made from the metal of a crashed automobile, which is interesting since this was, you know, where that kind of thing would have been made, and still is made, I think, in England. All right. This I had mentioned before, that after the bombing, they took two of the burned timbers and made a cross, and wrote underneath, "Father, forgive." And there's also a cross in front of that made out of nails. A cross of nails. It ties the crucifixion into, and resurrection into the cathedral, into the old cathedral, as well as the new. We'll find it also in the Britain War Room. There's a spot where this would be quite representative. In the Agnus Dei and the Wilfred Owen poem, that's with that. So you can remember this sort of image. I think the original timbers are gone. They replaced them with a replica because of, I suppose, the weathering and so on. It couldn't stand that. All right? So here we are now on ready to walk into the cathedral. We're down in the ruins and walking in. And the first thing you see is the back wall. And the back wall has clear glass panels incised with angels and saints, designed by John Hutton. And I think in the last movement of the Requiem, there's a place where the two soldiers meet in a kind of dream and death sequence, and it always reminds me of this particular wall. It's a ghostly image, and the way Britten handles the music, it seems like it's just hanging there in space, and you'll have to come back for that. Another view of the same thing, standing inside the new cathedral, looking out into the ruins. The same thing, but now we're standing back a little ways, and we begin to see the inside of the cathedral itself, the new cathedral. And we'll talk about that tapestry up front in just a minute. And there it is. So, this is a very controversial part of the cathedral. It's a tapestry, the largest in the world. It was designed by Graham Sutherland, woven in France, and it took them 360,000 hours to weave it. 360,000 hours. And here is something, here's man. This is a Christ figure, by the way. It reminds me of the Almighty Judge, you know, rather than sort of loving Savior kind of imagery, which is why some people may, and it looks, the bottom half looks kind of like a cocoon. Which it's strange. I mean, it's very impressive and very strange at the same time. And here's man, right between Jesus' feet. Yeah. And that's about the size of a regular man, if you want to get an idea of how huge that tapestry is. So if I were a good person to talk about art, I would talk about this, but I'm not. And there's another picture of it with the high altar down in front, made of concrete. This is called the Chapel of Unity. And the windows in it were donated by the German Evangelical Church. And the marble mosaic floor was given by the people of Sweden. So it's one of those spots, again, that's part of the reconciliation idea. Okay, here's the cathedral in use, Holy Communion service. And the vestments for the priests are also specially made for the cathedral.
Excuse me, Bob.
Yes.
Do you know why what the controversy is about, that tapestry?
I think it's just that the Christ figure is so huge and so kind of forbidding, mm-hmm. and that man is so tiny and kind of stuck between his feet. It's... I mean, I find it a little bit of a strange view. The Requiem Mass would not find it a strange view. And we'll see when you look at the Latin text. That, it does make sense with that, but it's kind of not with modern Christianity emphasis.
It's sort of a female body, and it almost looks pregnant.
Yes. Yeah. And I don't know if that was intentional or not. This would be back in 19, would have been designed in 1950s. So, I don't know. Or maybe some Buddha figures. That's what it reminds me too. Okay, going on. Here are four windows in the nave. There are 10 of them. And these were donated by various groups, such as the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, and the Warwickshire Freemasons, and the school children of Warwickshire, among others, some of the donors. So again, quite a variety. Oh, it's just another view of the chancel. Well, maybe that's it. Okay. Do you have any questions about these where I still have them up?
What are the things on the sides above the choir?
Yeah, I think they're just decorative.
Okay.
Yeah, I see them as birds.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do they have candles or lights or anything?
No, well, the I don't. Yes, they do. They do, but not all of them. You can see them along the front row, right? And then you have some candles down here at the choir stalls. But yeah, there's a single row that holds the candles.
You might almost think of them as. There's no suggestion that they're airplanes.
That's what it looks like.
Does it look well?
It's like origami.
Yes, it does.
Cranes,
yeah. And maybe the intention is that you can see it a lot of different ways.
Yeah. Is that where the choir sits?
The choir sits on its divided chancel. Here, half the choir sits here, and half the choir sits here, and they face each other, as in a traditional cathedral. It's really a bad idea that got started. But I'll tell you, it was originally, I suppose, comes from the monastery. So you just have a little bunch of monks, and they're in there by themselves and singing back and forth to one another. It's lovely if you're singing back and forth, but it's not great to get it out into the rest of the church or cathedral. It's hard work. And where do you stand the conductor? In front of the high altar or over to one side? No.
It was performed in that space?
Yes. Yeah, I should have mentioned that.
And the orchestra down here?
So the orchestra probably down on the main floor, and the choir, I suppose, on the stairs going up into the chancel. And they had to find a place to put the boys. And when we were there looking at the place, I can't figure out where they would have put them, because Britain wanted the boys' choir to be separate from the main choir and in use with the organ. But there's nothing to stand on up there by where you see the organ pipes. So whether they brought in, as Britain suggests, possibly a harmonium or portable organ, you know, and put the boys elsewhere in the church, like on a side aisle or in the back row, you know, I don't know. And I haven't been able to find anything in my reading that describes the original performance setup. Okay, any other questions about that? I'm sure the choir wouldn't have been standing there facing each other. That would have been almost impossible to coordinate. The thing that I'm not sure is whether they used the high altar area. I think the choir was probably too big for that, because it takes a large choir.
Where would the chamber orchestra have been then?
Well, Britain says right down front center.
In front of the major orchestra.
Yeah, and we'll be getting into these things tomorrow. But it was, you have major orchestra and choir, and then he wanted the chamber orchestra and the two soloists, Peter Pears and Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, in the front. And Britain didn't like directing, we're off on another subject, but it's kind of fun. He didn't like directing huge groups. So he had someone else, Davies, come in to direct the large group, and he directed Peter Pears and Dieskau and the small chamber group. So you can have that. So you have dual conductors. And the piece is written so that it actually works. There's almost no place where the two conductors have to stay synchronized. Very, very few spots for that. So it's not that hard to put together in that sense, that you have to see the conductor. That's the way I did it all the times that I did it. But I had the small chamber group off to the side. So that was also kind of a nice spatial effect with to have the large choral and our big orchestral forces front and center, and then to the right and slightly farther forward had the chamber orchestra and the director and the two soloists, and then up in the back balcony where the organ at St. Olaf was at that time anyway, that's where we had the organ and the boys or children. So you had coming from three spaces, and that's a good effect too. Okay, so we have the old and new against one another, the theme of forgiveness and reconciliation, and the idea of being international, where you're pulling things from all over the world, literally. Now, we're going to get into the text for the second half here. And you do have the text with you there on the program. Turn to the first page. Now, Britain starts with the old, with the traditional Latin Requiem Mass text. Now, you don't have that much anymore because of Vatican II, but this is the sort of the official, you know, at least from the Council of Trent up through the Vatican II, the official text. He doesn't use all of it. He uses most of it, pretty much the same parts that someone like Mozart and Verdi would have used, okay? But it's interesting. We keep thinking that it's a monolithic, everybody does it all, and it's not true. You get people like Faure and Durafle who leave out the big judgmental section, the sequence, the Dies Irae. And you get others leave out the closing Liber Me, and some people emphasize that because they want to have one more big dramatic moment. The composers love the Dies Irae and the Liber Me because it is so dramatic, and it's so much fun to scare people. But Britain is much more serious about it than that. He's not trying to impress. He has a message. So if we look at the big sections with the Roman numerals, those are basically built around that particular section of the Requiem Mass. So you see at the top, Requiem Aeternam, that's what's called the introit, where you're coming into the church, and you have the Requiem Aeternam Dona Eis Domine. Then what I've got there is the English translation underneath it by Jim May, who is a classics professor at St. Olaf. So it's a very good translation, one of the best that you'll see, all right? So that happens in the chorus. Children's choir come in and sings the proper hymn of praise in Zion, and then all of a sudden it's interrupted by the first poem of by Wilfred Owen. All right, and we'll come back to all of these poems. Then the Requiem is followed by where it says chorus Kyrie eleison. Of course, that's the first part of the ordinary, what we call the ordinary of the Mass. So you have the Requiem, introit, then you have the chorus of the ordinary, Kyrie, Christe, and Kyrie. Then follows the famous sequence, Dies Irae. And if you listen to the Latin, you'll see why it has this power. Dies Irae, Dies Ila, Solvet Seclum in Favila, Teste David cum Sibili, Sbila, Quantus tremor est futurus quando judex est venturus cuncta stricte discussurus. So it's scary. It's a scary language. It's a scary poem. And it's a good that's the reason Vatican II dropped it. I mean, I realize, I think, how it was very borderline Christian in some places. And the whole spirit of it was, you know, fearful rather than comforting. So, Britain sets the rhythm a little differently. He sets it, Dies Irae, Dies Ila, Solvet Seclum in Favila, Di-da-da-dam, Di-da-da-dam. So what's he done? He's made it asymmetrical, and we're going to notice that's important through the whole thing. And when he wants things to be unstable, he starts throwing in these the rhythms that are asymmetrical instead of 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3 or 1, 2, 3, 4 D A C Re D A C La D Da Dum. He does D A C Re D A C La. So it keeps throwing in that extra quarter note, Okay? And we'll listen to that tomorrow. You actually have heard it already today. So that sequence is long because he's inserted a lot of Wilfred Owen poems in it too. You turn over to the next page. More of the Dies Irae, more poems. You get to the bottom of that second page and you're still in the Dies Irae. Okay? You turn another page. Finally, we get to the offertorium. And it's offering the proper sacrifice to God. What happens in the use of the Wilfred Owen poems is you get an improper sacrifice, and we'll get to that in just a few minutes. You have Abraham sacrificing Isaac instead of listening to the angel. All right, so that's how it's profoundly disturbing to have that in the middle of the offertory. Okay, and then the Sanctus comes. There is no credo in the Requiem Mass in the ordinary. You go right to the Sanctus. Holy, 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 Lord God of Sabaoth. It's as you would have in the Mass. And at this point of great jubilation and triumph and all that, you get the darkest of the Wilfred Owen poems, the most hopeless of them all. And we'll get to that in just a minute. All right, it's followed by the Agnus Dei. And he has another poem there that refers to Christ as also having lost a limb in the war. So he ties the Lamb of God and the crucifixion into the scene from the war. And then finally you get the last section, which often is not done, the Librame. This is sort of after the main part of the Mass is done. And again, it refers back to the day of mourning and judgment until the very end. All right, so that's basically how the text is set up. Now, I'm going to take a little sidetrack and talk a bit about Wilfred Owen, the poet, because this is the other part of the text that you need to know. Okay, so you've got this traditional text, all in the right order except one place, and I'm not going to give that away just yet. There's one place where he varies from the Latin text, and it's a very important spot, and it was at the suggestion actually of Peter Pears, when they were talking, I suppose, about what poems to use and so on. There's one spot that Peter Pear says, why don't you use this Latin text instead of what's actually in the Requiem? Because it's very important for the theme. Oh, you know, I've gotten that far now. I've told you the story anyway. And it's the Dona Nobis Pacem, which at the end of the Agnus Dei, it should say once more, you know, let their souls be at rest. And instead, he goes to wait is in the regular Mass, where we say, you know, Lord, have mercy. You know, he takes away the sin of the world, have mercy, have mercy. And then the third time we say, what, grant us peace? So he puts that in, he inserts it at exactly the right moment. And it's one of the moments of hope, which we'll talk about tomorrow in the music. All right, so next, Wilfred Owen. Wilfred Owen was born in 1893. He started out as an evangelical Christian, as was his mother, but he gradually grew disenchanted with the liturgy and with ritual. So we have a writing from him after a Good Friday service when he was still a young man. Well, he was always a young man because he was killed young, as a young man. He said, I came out this hour and a half. After, this was after he was at a Good Friday service. He said, I came out this hour and a half older, otherwise unchanged. Yeah. So it ties in a little bit to last night's sermon. That he was there, nothing happened to him. It did it the usual old ritual, the way it was always done, and he didn't respond to it. He was also very conflicted about fighting. But he finally joined what was called the Artists' Rifles, in October 1915. He was soon hospitalized for shell shock, what was called shell shock then. We have a different name for it now. But while he was in the hospital, he also met Siegfried Sassoon. Now, if some of you are into pacifist writing, you may know that name. I don't know it. But anyway, it was a great influence on him. And that person, who had been very influenced by Robert Graves, all three of those people felt it necessary to participate in the war so that their pacifist statements would be beyond reproach. So they felt the only proper way to talk about peace through pacifism was to be in the midst of seeing what it was like to have people warring on each other and killing each other in war. In the trenches, religious sentiment and patriotism were treated with great cynicism. Wilfred Owen was shot in November 1918 and right to the end remained mixed in his feelings about pacifism. So even though he wrote these pacifist poems, there was still some question in his mind about what to do. Britain was more convinced about his pacifism. I would like to read you a poem from Wilfred Owen, one of his earlier poems, one that is not used in a requiem because I think maybe the imagery is too intense for what Britain wanted to use. And it's a short poem. Oh, you know what, though? I'm going to take it back because I wanted you to hear this in context of a poem by Rupert Brooke. Now, some of you may know that name. He was a much more famous poet in his day in England. And he wrote a lot of super patriotic poetry with more flowery language than what Wilfred Owen would use. And here's a short Rupert Brooke poem called The Soldier, written in 1914. If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. There shall be in that rich earth a richer dust concealed, a dust whom England bore, shaped, made aware, gave once her flowers to love, her ways to roam, a body of England's breathing English air, washed by the rivers, blessed by sons of home. And think, this heart, all evil shed away, a pulse in the eternal mind, no less gives somewhere back the thoughts by England given. Her sights and sounds, dreams happy as her day, and laughter learnt of friends, and gentleness in hearts of peace under an English heaven. So it's sort of England, wonderful England, reminded all over, and even from his dust, you know, one can be reminded of England, wherever his dust should end up in the war. So here is a stark contrast to that by Wilfred Owen, obviously not popular during the First World War. If in some smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in, and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face like a devil's sick of sin. If you could hear at every jolt the blood come gurgling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues. My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori, which means, what? Yeah, the old lie. So sweet and proper it is, or honorable it is, to die for one's country. Yeah. Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. So, very, very dramatic, very starkly contrasting to the Rupert Brooke. Just as a sidelight, it's a little bit ironic when Cora and I and our twins went to England on sabbatical the second time. We were in Cambridge, and that's where Rupert Brooke was headquartered. And we stayed in the little town of Grantchester, just outside of Cambridge. And what do you suppose the pub was? The Rupert Brooke of all. So, and I was very much into the war record at that time. I thought, how ironic. You know, we walk into Cambridge and we keep going by Rupert Brooke is still honored, in the, at least with drinks. Okay, a little bit more from the record jacket notes about Wilfred Owen. The popular poet of the First World War was Rupert Brooke, who seemed to many to embody an ideal image of radiant British youth sacrificing itself for his country. His work was in tune with the conventional patriotic sentiments of the time. but the poetry of Wilfred Owen, who was killed in France just before the armistice in 1918, after winning the Military Cross, had to wait longer to be known. Owen was only 25. Well, and not only that, but he was made head of his platoon, or whatever you call it. Owen was only 25, but his poems were profound and are profoundly disturbing. They made no appeal to the accepted opinions of his time about poetry or war. They were not about what soldiers gloriously did, but what they had unforgivably been made to do by others and to suffer themselves. Owen did not accept what he called the old lie, that it was necessarily glorious or even fitting to die for one's own or any other country, or that a country was necessarily or perhaps even justified in making the kind of war he knew. As he saw and experienced it, war appeared as a hellish outrage on a huge scale against humanity and a violation of Christianity. He shared the destiny of millions of both sides, but unlike them, he had the sensibility to see what war now really meant, and the power to explain it. He wrote, "My subject is war and the pity of war. The poetry is in the pity." And that actually is in the dedicatory page of the Britain War Requiem score. That's the quote he has from from Wilfred Owen.
Could you repeat that sentence?
Yes, "My subject is war and the pity of war. The poetry is in the pity." Into his poetry went the pity, not of a detached outsider or a sentimentalist, nor simply that of a humane officer for his men, whose lives he cannot save, and to whom he cannot hold out any hope, but the pity of an imaginative man for fellow sufferers unable to speak for themselves to later generations. And since right could hardly be on either side in a struggle which, by Christian and humane standards, seemed to him utterly wrong, pity led to the vision of some kind of reconciliation beyond the tortured and shapeless present. This is most explicit in the line from the poem Strange Meeting, which closes the Requiem. "The quietly and simply sung, 'I am the enemy you killed, my friend.'" So, you've got trench warfare going on. You have over half of the young men in England being slaughtered at that time. It's amazing. I mean, we think about how terrible it is, was in Vietnam, and our present war that still hasn't stopped, although we've kind of been ignoring it lately. But for that war, you know, to think, okay, what if half of all the American men of, like, say, normal marrying age were killed, slaughtered in the war? That got nowhere. You know, people fighting back and forth into trenches, moving a few feet this way, moving a few feet back. Terrible, terrible war. Just a few things about Owen's poetry. He honors the dead with devoted craftsmanship. And of course, that's what Britain does in his music. It's what the cathedral builders did. And Owen's poetry is the perfect choice because it's beautifully crafted. Owen uses the language and images of war and transforms them into expressing the experience of the soldiers. We'll see that right away in the first poem that we're going to look at. He expressed anger by not obscuring the horrors of war, and by rejecting lofty maxims and imperialist rhetoric. And he takes his anger and aims it at that rhetoric and the old men running the war, actually, instead of the enemy. He raises religious questions, but does not deliver religious platitudes. He juxtaposes hope and despair, and we'll see places where Britain picks that up in his music. And he uses nightmare and sleep imagery. And finally, he's concerned about the psychological damage that war does to human beings. And again, here he's way ahead of his time, because we're still trying to convince the people who have money that, you know, something does happen to the soldiers for which they need treatment. And here is, way back in the First World War, you know, almost 100 years ago now, a poet sort of sensing and expressing what that's all about. All right, now let's go back to the program and read some of the poems and talk about the imagery. And then we'll pick this up again as we go through the music tomorrow. We'll see how Britten gives motifs to this. But let's look just at the poetry. I haven't ever had a chance to discuss this work this way, where I do the poetry outside of what Britten has done to it, because there's never been enough time. So it's sort of a gift for me to be here and be able to take the time and look at the poetry for what it is all by itself, right? Now, having said this about looking at it, you do need to know that Britten made some changes in it. And in order to make it a little more universal, so instead of talking about fighting in France and Germany, he would use other words to express the fighting. Okay? And there are a couple of things, like the very vivid imagery that Owen used in the poem I read to you already, that he excises from some of it so that it, in a sense, almost doesn't become a distraction from the overall idea that he's trying to express and pull out of the poetry. So, if you look under where it says children's choir, there's a tenor solo. All the Wilfred Owen poetry is sung by the tenor and the baritone, who represent the two combatants. You have Peter Pears, the Englishman, Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, the German, and they talk sometimes separately and sometimes to one another, and have the reconciliation at the end. Very powerful for Europe at that time. Okay, so the tenor solo sung by Peter Pears is based on a poem, Anthem for Doomed Youth is the title for this, Anthem for Doomed Youth. And you've just heard the bells ringing, and in the Requiem Mass that's supporting the Latin text of the Requiem, and all of a sudden the tenor comes in and says, what passing bells, that's bells when you die, for these who die as cattle, only the monstrous anger of the guns, only the starting rifles' rapid rattle can patter out their hasty orisons. So you've got the instruments of war instead of the instruments of the church and the orchestra. And you have hasty orisons would be prayers. No mockeries for them from prayers or bells, nor any voice of mourning, save the choirs, the shrill, demented choirs of wailing shells, and bugles calling for them from sad shires. What candles may be held to speed them all? Not in the hands of boys, but in their eyes shall shine the holy glimmers of goodbyes. The pallor of girls' brows shall be their pall, their flowers the tenderness of silent minds, and each slow dusk, a drawing down of blinds. Very sad poem. And what Britten's, you're going to see what he does, is he ties this thing about not in the hands of boys to what the boys have just sung in the regular Latin Mass. So he ties it across. And then you have the Kyrie and Christe Eleison. All right, next poem comes in the Dies Irae. If you look down there in the second line where it says baritone solo, this is a poem called Bugles Sang. Bugles sang, saddening the evening air, and bugles answered, sorrowful to hear. Voices of boys were by the riverside. Sleep mothered them and left the twilight sad. The shadow of the morrow weighed on men. Voices of old despondency resigned, bowed by the shadow of the morrow, slept. And again, where this is used in the Requiem Mass reflects the Latin text, where one is waiting for judgment to come. Here you have the soldiers waiting for the battle to come. And we're going to see that there are music motifs that represent the battle and bugle calls, and they get used right at this point. So if you don't get it, that you're sitting there reading the poetry, you don't get the connection between the bugles and the call to Judgment Day, the last trumpet, you'll get it because Britten uses those motifs here to tie it through. I can't help talking about the music. Okay, now we're going down to the next line, where it says tenor and baritone solos. Interesting title for this poem. It's called The Next War. So here he is in the First World War, the war to end all wars, and you've got a poet writing The Next War. Out there and very bravura, It's after you've just talked about in the Latin Mass, Fount of Compassion, have pity on me, save me. You've got the two soldiers saying, ah, we're not scared about death. Out there we walk quite friendly up to death. Sat down and eaten with him, cool and bland. Pardoned by his spilling mess tins in our hand, we've sniffed the green, thick odor of his breath. Our eyes wept, but our courage didn't writhe. He spat at us with bullets, and he's coughed shrapnel. We chorused when he sang aloft. We whistled while he shaved us with his scythe. Oh, death was never enemy of ours. We laughed at him. We leagued with him, old chum. No soldiers paid to kick against his powers. We laughed, knowing that better men would come and greater wars, when each proud fighter brags he wars on death for life, not men for flags. Yeah, so those, the eating, the mess tins, and the being shaved with the scythe and coughing shrapnel. Yeah, again, very, very strong imagery, but I think very appropriate. All right. Now, over in the next line, we have the baritone solo on seeing a piece of our artillery brought into action. Right? So you've got in the text of the Requiem Mass, I beg prostrate in the supplicant, a heart, I'm contrite. You're contrite, you're bowing forward, you're bowing down. In here, you've got the gun being lifted up. And here's the poem that's the most ambiguous about its being pacifist or not, I think. Be slowly lifted up, thou long black arm, great gun towering toward heaven, about to curse. Reach at that arrogance which needs thy harm, and beat it down before its sins grow worse. But when thy spell be cast complete and whole, may God curse thee and cut thee from our soul. And then it goes into the Dies Irae text again, the very intense and huge orchestration. So it's cut thee from our soul, but it also has sort of this blast of the firing of the artillery for what good it might do, that it possibly could do. I know, it's a question. All right, you get down now to the bottom of the next chorus. And you have the Lacrimosa at the bottom of that same line. If you look in the Requiem text, tearful that day when man will arise from the ashes to be judged on one on trial. Therefore spare him, God. Therefore spare him. Spare him. You turn the page, and you have the Wilfred Owen poem called Futility. And it's the same thing. It's the soldier pleading to spare this buddy who's been killed. And Britton weaves this beautifully into the text that we just talked about. Move him into the sun. Gently its touch awoke him once, at home, whispering of fields unsown. Always it woke him, even in France, until this morning and this snow. If anything might rouse him now, the kind old sun will know. Think how it wakes the seeds. Woke once the clays of a cold star. Our limbs so dear achieved, our sides full nerved, still warm, too hard to stir. Was it for this the clay grew tall? Oh, what made fatuous sunbeams toil to break earth's sleep at all? So what is the point? What's the point of life if this is what you're doing with it? All right, so another poem that's stuck into the middle of the offertory. And I've already mentioned this, so you have this, the sacrifice that goes on. You have, interestingly, also St. Michael, and this is St. Michael's church, cathedral. So there's kind of a tie in there from the offertory text. Okay, and at the end of that, you have the text, Quam olim Abrahe promisisti, which you once promised to Abraham and to his seed. All right? And then you get the poem. Now, this is one I always have trouble reading. So Abram rose and clave the wood and went and took the fire with him and a knife. And as they sojourned, both of them together, Isaac the firstborn spake and said, My father, behold the preparations, fire and iron, but where the lamb for this burnt offering? Then Abraham bound the youth with belts and straps, and builded parapets and trenches there, and stretched forth the knife to slay his son. When lo, an angel called him out of heaven, saying, Lay not thy hand upon the lad, neither do anything to him. Behold, a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. Offer the ram of pride instead of him. But the old man would not so, but slew his son. That always chokes me. And then the children or the boys sing, What's the proper sacrifice? You know, that's what we want to offer. And it seems great. It's the children offering the hope for the future, saying, here's the proper sacrifice. But when the chorus comes in, everything gets turned absolutely upside down by what's happened. And we'll talk about what music devices he uses to do this. But everything is upside down from what he did the first time that text came in, before the terrible poem about Abraham and Isaac. All right, the Sanctus comes next. You have this glorious music, triumphant music, and then you get the baritone solo, which is the most hopeless poem of all. And I'll let you read that yourself so we can finish on time. Just quickly read the baritone solo called The End, is the title of that. So it's the point at which the Wilfred Owen poetry and the Latin Mass are the most far apart, that the juxtaposition is the biggest stretch of things. All right, the Agnus Dei. Here, Britain has interspersed the Wilfred Owen text with the Agnus Dei, and you'll see why it's used here. Once one ever hangs where shall roads part, there is obviously a figure of Christ in a Calvary, or one of these at the crossroads, but it's a common name. A shrine.
Yeah.
A little shrine with a crucifix in it. In this war, he too lost a limb, but his disciples hide apart, and now the soldiers bear with him. Near Golgotha strolls many a priest, and in their faces there is pride that they were flesh marked by the beast by whom the gentle Christ's denied. The scribes and all the people shove and bawl allegiance to the state, but they who love the greater love lay down their life. They do not hate. And it's a sort of a moment of hope, of pointing away that this is again the proper way to act, and it ends with the grandest peace, Dona Nobis Pacem, and Britain responds to that poem at that point. All right, and the Dona Nobis Pacem, it's one of the most hopeful spots in the Mass. All right, the Libra Me, you get apocalyptic vision of the final judgment in the original Latin text. And what you get instead of the final judgment, when you get the Wilfred Owen poem in that next line, where it says tenor solo, Strange Meeting is the title of this poem. It's the final meeting of the soldiers. So they've been in battle, they've been fighting each other. Now, they're either both dead, or one of them is dead and the other is having a nightmare, which is the way I like to look at it. It sort of ties me into it better, to say he's having a nightmare about what happened in the war. And again, it ties into what we've been hearing about, what they used to call battle fatigue and so on. All right. And again, I'm going to have you read that. This is a long poem. It's one that Wilfred Owen actually did not finish. And this is one where there are a few spots Benjamin Britten made some changes that are actually quite beautiful if you compare it with the old one. So what passing bells for those who are thinking about the War Requiem. So take a read down. And that final poem ends with Let Us Sleep Now. And you get a sleep. And then you turn the page one more time. I'll let you read that so you can take what time you want to. And you get Requiescat in Pace, Requiem Aeternam, and so on, grant them peace. But when the children join in that chorus, they go back and sing the thing that marked, and we're going to do this first thing tomorrow, marked the despair and death and so on, the Hopi, which is the tritone, the interval of the tritone. And all of a sudden, the children sing that. And so while the rest of them, we have Let Us Sleep Now, Reconciliation, the final musical resolution, and so on. The children up from far away are singing the tritone as the warning that this may not be over. You know, that we've planted the seeds, and the seeds are of war and death, as well as possibility of reconciliation. So Britain does not provide easy answers or, you know, make everything comfortable and beautiful at the end. It is beautiful, but there's that tritone, that dissonant interval that keeps ringing away in our ears as a possibility for the future. So you had a question, Dorothy?
Oh, I wondered whether Madison scripted some of them for the German and some of the poems for the German to sing and some of the poems for the Englishman to sing. For example, the poem of the Big Black Gun was sung by the German.
Yes.
You know, I just wonder.
I like to think that the last one is, it's the German who is the one who is killed.
Uh-huh.
And that speaks last and says, you know, I'm the enemy you killed, my friend.
Okay.
And so you have primarily an English audience listening to this, and it's the German talking. So I think that one,
okay.
I think that's, I would say, is right.
Uh-huh.
And tell him how moved.
Well, yes, Fisher D. Scott in the original performance. If you get this way, you can't sing very well. And he was doing that and choked. Couldn't sing. Now, of course, we have the recording is a recording session. And so he sings it dramatically and beautifully. But apparently in the original, he couldn't sing through it. I don't know how much he missed of the of the text.
Yeah. At what point did he choke?
In the meeting, the poem, the very last poem,
mm-hmm.
and it's the one that says, "I'm the enemy you killed, my friend." And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's that last poem.
But you don't know which line.
I don't know which line. I wish there is a book on Britain's War Requiem, but it doesn't say much about the original performance. It gives a lot of information and great information, but not that.
Oh, and tell him about the soprano. The Russians wouldn't let her come.
Yeah, Galina Vishnevskaya was supposed to be the soprano soloist. So you had Russian, German, English. And she, when she got back to Russia and she was expected to do something by the Soviet government, they would not let her out of the country. So at the last minute, Heather Harper, the English woman, learned a rather difficult solo and sang it in the original performance. But the Soviets, for some reason, let Galina go eventually, and then she did the performance. So what we hear on this so-called original performance recording is actually a recording session, and Galina was back. She is Rostropovich, that's his wife, and Rostropovich and Britain had been having conversations and become good friends, and that's part of the reason, in addition to liking Galina's voice, because she's very dramatic, a very dramatic soprano, you know, much more than Heather Harper would have been. And he writes music, obviously, for her when she comes in. It sounds a little bit like Verdi when she comes in. Anything else I should talk about? Probably should quit. About this, the handout. If you're coming back, or if you really want to have it and aren't coming back, that's fine, keep it. If you're going to not come back and really don't want to have this lying around your house, just leave it here, and then we make fewer copies for the next sessions. So either way, or if you'd rather leave it here so you don't have to carry it with you, that's fine too. But you might want to read the poetry a second time without my inflections, putting in your own music until you hear Britain's view.
And tomorrow your session's in the morning.
My session's in the morning tomorrow.
10:45?
10, yes, after break. And we'll start listening to the music of it. We'll probably get through the basic motifs, and they're not that many, actually. And then we'll do the first movement and show you how Britain is thinking and putting things together. And then the next day we'll do that Dies Irae, up through the Abraham and Isaac poem. I mean, these are my plans. And then the next day, we'll do the second half of the Requiem. And there's more to it. As I say, once you know part of it, you don't know it all. He keeps doing things that are absolutely amazing. And then the last day will be a listening session where I will say very little, except maybe to remind, say, remember, here comes such and such, and we'll listen to the straight through the whole performance. There is nothing like listening to it. I hate to break it up the way I'm going to break it up, because it loses some of the impact. It has a tremendous impact to hear the whole thing. And it's even more impact if you ever have a chance to hear it live in a place with good acoustics and a grand organ, because they're the, you can't, even on the best CD player, there's something different about having the live people and the energy that comes. A recording session essentially kills off a lot of the intensity and liveness, if you can compare the two. It gives you more clarity, maybe, especially on CDs. It gives you, more detail. And people being very careful to be perfect. And when you go to live performance, you get those little things that happen because people are so intense and so committed that their voices may break a little bit, or they may sing a little sharp or a little flat because they're so intense and into it, and not listening in trying to be perfect, but listening and trying to express what's there. Right.
Nevertheless, would you recommend a recording?
I would recommend the original from the one that their recording session. Okay. Of course, they're all my own. No. What mine do will have you hear a bunch of young people singing with great and non-professional orchestra, playing with a great intensity, with that kind of commitment that you get out of young people. But if you want to hear, and you know, Britten has his hand in that recording, so it's as close as you're going to get to what he heard in his mind, I think. So that's why I would recommend that. The Shaw recording is very good also.
Is
Robert
that
Shaw.
What you're going to play tomorrow?
I'm going to play it. I'll do the Britten's. Yeah. I have mine here if anyone ever begs me that. They just have to hear another viewpoint. But we won't do both of them.